thank you for the invitation to, yeah, to this institute, to be able to come to LA for the first time. Yeah, as already has been said, this is a joint work with Lukas Neumann, and yes, you will also see there will be plenty of links to a talk we shall hear in the afternoon, I think, by José Antonio Carrillo. So certainly there will be a lot of relations between what I'm going to talk about and what he will discuss. The issue of the talk is, as I said, is in quantum kinetic theory, whatever that is. Well, what we think quantum kinetic theory is an attempt to model certain systems in a kind of hybrid way, namely that you want to essentially model it by doing classical kinetic equations, which, however, have to be modified in such a way that you can incorporate certain quantum mechanical aspects. And one thing that is here, or what is interesting here, is what interested us, is that we want to discuss some models which are able to incorporate generalized statistics, so more general steady states than just the usual classical Maxwellians. So here we would like to have a model which is able to describe the bosons and fermions in the sense that the steady states you get out have the right physically the correct physical equilibrium states, which are both Einstein or Fermi-Dirac distributions. And you can do this in several, I mean, there has been several attempts to do so, mostly based on Boltzmann-type equations. The most basic equations, the Oehling-Uhlenbeck equation. And here we will not talk about Boltzmann-type problems or Boltzmann-type equations, but rather Fokker-Planck-type equations. So this is basically the model we're going to consider. So F here is indeed a classical kinetic, a classical phase-based distribution. So no Wigner function or anything which you might think here. So this is a positive phase-based distribution normalized to one, if you wish. And this is the model we are going to consider, so especially inhomogeneous model. And you see here is the diffusion operator of Fokker-Planck type with a nonlinear drift here. And the nonlinearity is basically this quadratic form here, where kappa in the following will always denote either plus or minus one.
The kappa would be plus or minus one over h. Is that correct? There is scaling.
Yeah, well, here everything is dimensionless scaled, so, but yeah, it would be one over h bar, I guess. Yeah. So kappa equal to plus one would then correspond to bosons, and kappa equal to minus one would correspond to fermions. In the following, our phase space will be, I mean, the velocity variable will vary in RD, whereas the spatial variable X will vary on the torus. The selection of what?
Of the kappa, of K.
Yes.
Why the sign, I mean, what is the interpretation of plus or minus? I mean,
well,
why is bosons and arrows?
Right, kappa equal to plus one is bosons. It simply gives the right steady state. That's basically
that's
the answer, the pragmatic answer.
In this subject paper, is there a derivation as a Grazing collision?
There are some formal arguments. I mean, these kind of nonlinearities basically appear already in the Uhlenbeck or Boson-Boltzmann or whatever you want to call it equation. And yeah, they, maybe not in this paper, but I know at least one paper of another guy, which I'm going to mention later, where he does a formal Grazing collision limit from this Uhlenbeck and gets out this. These guys here, they basically do a Brownian motion, or they write down a Brownian motion problem, and they simply impose it such that they get the right steady state. So, yeah. I mean, you cannot expect to have really fundamental derivation of such an equation. I think this is a modeling.
I mean, even in the classical Foucault Planck case, completely fundamental.
Yeah. Okay, so as I said here, the x will vary on the torus, which is can be considered as a replacement for a confining potential, and which makes life mathematically much more easier. And so, in this case, what you check is that you have the following steady states. Namely steady states of this form. So here you see if kappa equal to plus 1, you get the Bose-Boltzmann distribution, and kappa equal to minus 1, you get the Fermi-Dirac distribution. And this theta here is basically a constant, which is written here in this form in order to guarantee that this steady state has the same mass as your initial function. So by varying this theta, basically you can tune the F infinity such that it has mass equal to capital M. Of course, it's not completely true. Before you want, yeah?
Yes.
Because at least for the bosonic case, you run into trouble. Namely, for the bosonic case, you check that the smaller the theta is, the more mass you can put into this F infinity. So that the maximum amount of mass you can put in is found for theta equal to zero. And the problem is, okay, you integrate this distribution then, and what you find is that for space dimension d larger or equal than 3, this thing here is simply a given or a computable number. I didn't compute it here, so. Whatever it is a fixed number. And this, of course, gets you into trouble because it basically tells you that you cannot associate an arbitrary large amount of mass to this steady state. So there is basically a threshold of mass for these kind of steady states. And this, of course, is a well-known observation, and I think has been done by Einstein himself. And has been the first argument for the existence of what is called the Bose-Einstein condensate, because the amount of mass you're lacking, or assume that you start with a phase-based distribution which has a mass m which is bigger than this critical one, since you have mass conservation. I mean the mass has to go somewhere, and what you do is you have to add to this regular steady state a delta measure with the appropriate constant in front to take into account or to the missing mass. And this delta is exactly what people would then call a Bose-Einstein condensate in this modeling attempt by classical kinetic equations.
So your equation mass is the only conservation law, right?
Here mass is the only conservation law. And we can't, but people do this typically.
Oh, okay.
But if
people don't have the delta, I start with something which has too big of a mass.
Yeah. I have absolutely no idea. Well, in for this model, if I start with something which has a mass which is too big,
supercritical.
Is supercritical, I guess you will not have the
it should
blow up. No,
I don't think so.
But I have not.
Yeah.
I mean here, yeah, for the Bose-Boltzmann problem, I mean this is studied now by Mischler and Escobedo and so on, and I guess they know that it blows up in infinite time.
No. They
no?
don't know.
They don't
they
know?
Have, I mean they have no
in the
I mean
quantum equation it blows up in infinite time, and in the Riemann-Boltzmann it's not.
No,
but
no, precisely speaking for unrealistic scattering rates, they have a result in the radially symmetric case, which says that basically if you start with L1, it remains in L1, the solution remains in L1. how can you see? We have tried it numerically, but it's very hard to see a delta.
Yes.
I mean, you get something big, but the delta is a.
Well, they also have a, don't they have some sort of profile?
No. But the real thing would be to check the realistic scattering rates. Nobody knows.
Well, I only know that these people, which I quote here, this Sopic, for the spatially homogeneous case, they claim to have some sort of a profile, something like this, for the blow up. Yeah, for the spatially homogeneous.
Profile in time?
No, a profile. Yeah, they can do some sort of formal asymptotics, which for how the delta evolves, and so I think so. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, but we cannot do anything like this, so we have to stay away from this problem, or assume that from now on the mass is always subcritical, because yeah. This is what we will not discuss here any notions of Bose, Einstein, Condon set. We have to stay in the regime of regular steady states. And yeah, this basically means that we have to assume theta to be strictly positive.
Okay.
What we are interested in is then the convergence of the solution of the time-dependent problem towards these regular steady states. And as I said, for the specially homogeneous case, there has been work of Jose Antonio Carrillo, Rosado, and Salvarani, where they basically used entropy dissipation techniques to study this trend to equilibrium. And speaking of entropy, here is the quantum mechanical entropy associated to this problem. So you see, this is the sum of the free energy, and here you have the usual F log F, but here you see this kappa, entering here, which makes this relative entropy the quantum mechanical one, and. As I said, for the specially homogeneous case, these entropy dissipation techniques are used to study the trend to equilibrium. For our specially inhomogeneous case, we don't rely on entropy. We rather do a classical sort of energy estimate type of approach. And in particular, it's only a partial result in the sense that what we have to assume is that we start with an initial data which is somewhat close to the steady state, and this is basically, all of this is sort of inspired by the work of Clément Moreau and Lucas Neumann, where they really give a systematic kind of approach for this, how to do this with this energy type estimates. So what we are going to do is we are linearizing the solution of our equation. We linearize it around this F infinity, and so you write in this form, and here for convenience we introduce this scaling factor here, square root of mu infinity, where the mu infinity in the following will obviously denote this basically this quadratic function F infinity. And so what you do is, of course, you plug it in and you derive an equation now for the new unknown G, which is the perturbation around the equilibrium state, and which is such that this integral times this scaling factor here has, of course, mass zero. And then this is basically the theorem we can prove. So assume that you start with an initial data, F0, which is of this particular form, and as I said here, the theta has to be positive, and there are some similarity issues involved, so this is here the Sobolev index, k has to be big enough, then say if this g0 here, this perturbation in the hk Sobolev space is small enough, so if this norm is small enough, which basically tells you that this is what we mean by perturbation, perturbative regime, that this norm is small enough, then you know first of all that the nonlinear problem has a unique solution f for all time, and in particular you get these exponentially decay towards the steady state, with a constant here tau, which in principle one could compute. We didn't really compute it explicitly, but in principle one could give a number for this. So you have exponential decay towards the steady state, at least in the case where you start close to it, which is maybe not so surprisingly. As I said, for bosons, it is really crucial to avoid being in the supercritical regime. So for bosons, this theta being strictly positive is really to avoid the formation of a Bose-Einstein condensate, because as I said, there are arguments, at least for the Bose-Boltzmann equation, that there is no, if you really have the formation of a condensate, that there is no such thing like exponential decay towards this steady state. There are different time scales involved. The Bose-Einstein condensate, at least I remember in this paper by Michel and Escobedo, they give some arguments that the time scale is a bit different. So you cannot expect such an exponential decay towards the Bose-Einstein condensate, I think. And there are also in this paper of Sopik and so, these people also claim that there are other time scales evolving. You might also note that we, due to our mathematical approach, we also have to impose theta being strictly positive in the case of fermions, which is a drawback of our method. And this simply comes out of the mathematics. You need certain quantities to be positive, and this we can only guarantee if theta is positive for fermions. Whereas in principle, for fermions, physically speaking, you would allow theta to range in all of R. So here we cannot do so. We have to impose this additional restriction, which physically speaking corresponds, can be interpreted of assuming that we are in a regime where the temperature is high enough, such that theta is then positive. From this, since the title of this workshop involves entropy, I want to just state that from the result we have on the solution, of course, you get immediately this corollary on the relative entropy. So you have, the difference of, so this is really the relative entropy, right? So the difference of this H functional of the solution minus the entropy of H infinity, this also decays. This also decays exponentially, so what you have is also exponential decay in relative entropy. As I said, there is this drawback with the theta, and this approach also allows us to do a bit more. Namely, we also found an even more obscure model in the literature which has been discussed by several people. The first one I found is Harris in 1979, where not only the Fokker-Planck, so that the diffusion operator here has a nonlinearity, but also the usual transport part picks up a nonlinearity. And you can check that also this model has the same steady states f infinity as the one I've shown you before. And what we can do is we can also discuss, or we basically get the same result as we got before also for these kind of models, under the additional assumption that for the bosonic case, the theta not only has to be positive, but it has to be even bigger. It has to be bigger than a certain number theta star. This number theta star, unfortunately, is given by a transcendental equation, so I cannot really give a number for it. Okay, we computed it numerically to be 0.45. Don't know what this means. I don't think it has any physical meaning at all. It is basically a relict of our mathematical approach that we need this theta to be big enough.
And how did they come up with the precise form of the equation?
stochastic particle modeling.
Well, actually, that's sort of actually the more natural form of the equation, right? Because it's really, it is, if you take the Pn, it's the equation commutator, right?
Well, yeah.
The plus of bracket with the Hilbert potential. The potential has to do is of that form.
Well,
part of this P kappa F, where that comes from, I mean, that's following.
I mean, what these people do, they do again stochastic particles, and they impose a certain kind of current.
No, what I'm saying is,
classical
dynamics, right?
This is not a Hamiltonian system.
They do classical dynamics.
They do classical dynamics. They do classical dynamics. Okay. So the rest of the talk, I basically will briefly discuss with you. Discuss here the proof of this result, and in the end also discuss some open problems. And so for the proof, of course, the first thing you do is study the linearized Fokker Planck operator. So if you plug in this linearization, so this is what you get. So this is the linearized operator here, where this eta infinity now denotes basically the derivative of this mu infinity with respect to f infinity. And what you check is that the linearized Fokker Planck operator has this nice form. So, I mean, it's self-adjoint, and you immediately see here that the kernel of this thing is given by this square root of mu infinity. So these are this is the kernel of the linearized Fokker Planck operator, which then allows you to define the projections onto this kernel capital pi here in such a way where this rho infinity now has to be included. So this is a constant here, right? So this has to be included for normalization. What we do in the following is we work in a weighted, basically in a weighted H1 space, so to speak. So this capital lambda here is a space of functions which have this norm bounded. So you see here is the gradient entering, and here you have this part here, where here you see for the classical Fokker Planck equation, this eta would simply be 1, and this would be the corresponding weighted space. So here we have this eta to be taken into account, and so this is all here in just in the kinetic or in the momentum variable. The full norm capital lambda is then taking this one and takes the usual two norm out outside of this thing. This is, you might want to ask why precisely this space. Well, basically this space somewhat comes out naturally when you try to impose certain or try to prove certain properties of the linearized collision operator. And these properties are summed up in these two lemmas. And the essential property, of course, of this L is this coercivity here. So so in this lemma, this basically tells you that this L here, so that the inner product of L G with G here, this is smaller than some strictly positive lambda or minus lambda, so spectral gap here basically, and times the G itself. Of course, you have to subtract always the kernel or the projection of the big kernel here. So this is an essential property of L, and you get a similar kind of thing also for the derivatives with respect to P here, where you find two constants here, two positive constants such that this inequality holds. To prove this, actually what you check is that this mu infinity here, the element of the kernel of this operator satisfies the Poincaré inequality. So what you prove is that this Poincaré inequality here holds true for this measure mu infinity. And in order, I mean, how to prove this? basically we prove this by the classical Horace Crook argument by writing the mu infinity in the form like e to the minus a, where a is this potential, or you define an a like minus logarithm of mu infinity, and what you check is that this a has two parts. One is the uniformly convex function, and then there is this thing here which you check is in L infinity. So you know by this argument of Horace Crook that the measure mu infinity is such that this Poincaré inequality holds. And yeah, another important property, which I cannot really associate a name to it, is some sort of quadratic behavior of this linearized operator L. So if you take the inner product here with L of H with a different function g, what you find is that you get this kind of quadratic behavior here with respect to this lambda p norm. So this property, together with the coercivity, basically forces you to induce, it forced us to induce this base lambda p. And for these results, these results actually show why we need this theta to be positive even in the fermionic case. It's basically that this strange factor this strange factor eta infinity here has to, for the fermionic case, this factor here can change sign, right? Because it's 1 minus 2 times f infinity. And that's, unfortunately, this is very bad, and we cannot allow to do it. And so we basically have to assume that this f infinity, we have to assume that theta is positive such that then this thing here stays positive all the time, which for fermions, which typically would have this, for physically speaking, you would have this bound here that f infinity is always smaller than 1. But here, this basically tells us that for fermions, our f infinity has to be smaller than 1/2, which corresponds to the fact that we are in a high enough temperature regime. Okay. So having established these properties of the linearized collision operator, what you do is you prove the exponential decay of the solution for this linearized equation. So this is the thing you prove. So g is now the solution of the linearized equation, and what you prove is that it decays towards equilibrium, which is now given, of course, by the square root of the mu infinity times some constant factor here, taking into account mass normalization, that this g decays towards this g infinity exponentially fast. And indeed, this rate here is the rate which also appears in the theorem above. And so, this is sort of what at the core of the proof for the whole theorem, because if having established this, it's then rather easy to translate this exponential decay property towards the full nonlinear problem, at least in a perturbative regime where you start close to the equilibrium. So just to give you the main idea on how to prove this, what you do is, as I said, we don't use here an entropy dissipation approach. What we do is we consider the time evolution of a different functional, namely some sort of an energy kind of functional. So all I'm going to talk about is how to prove this. So for the lowest subtle index k equal to 1. So what you do is, we follow this approach by Moreau-Neumann, as I said before, and we consider the time evolution of this thing here. So here's the usual L2 norm of g plus the L2 norm of the gradient with respect to x and p. And then there is this essential part here where you have this mixed derivative gradient with respect to x times gradient with respect to p. And you allow yourself for certain numbers here, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, and which are positive constants. And in the trick in the following will be, of course, to choose delta small enough with respect to beta and gamma, such that this thing here basically induces you a norm which is equivalent to the H1 norm. Yet you cannot simply cross out this part and take delta to be 0, Because this is, I mean, you really have to take into account this thing here in order to get a closed set of estimates in the end. So you really have to take this into account. And what you want to prove, or what we prove then is that the time evolution of this functional here, the time derivative of f, is bounded above by some negative, that it decays in such that. So the time evolution, I mean, here's the precise statement. You have minus some positive constant C trigger times this thing itself again, basically. So how to do this? Well, basically, you just start by considering the time evolution of all of these parts here separately and use the properties of the linearized collision operator. So. First thing for the L2 norm is the most simple one, of course. The time derivative of the L2 norm squared here. So first thing you realize is that the transport part, so this p dot gradient in x, does not contribute due to its divergence form. So you get this inner product here, which, as I said before, is this coercivity property. So you have this inequality. Similarly, for the gradient with respect to x of this g, you use the fact that the linearized collision operator L only acts in the velocity variable p, so it commutes here, and again you get basically the same thing here, just with the derivatives with respect to p, with respect to x into it. For the derivatives with respect to p, you have to work a bit more. I don't show you the details, but basically by using Poincaré inequality on the torus, and the fact that this projection here has zero mean for this Poincaré inequality, what you find out is that you get this kind of estimate here. So you see here, this thing here is already nice here. So this decays here with minus k, with some constant minus k1 here. Then you get this part, which is similar to the one above. And finally, you have this term here, which is a bit nasty because this here has the wrong sign, so to say. It does not decay, and it is the gradient with respect to x, which you cannot control yet, because here you only have the gradient with respect to x minus the projection. So you have to do something to take into account this part here. And what to do is, basically, what you do is you look at the time evolution of this mixed derivative. And this really, I mean, here sort of comes into play the fact that you not only have operator L which dissipates, because I mean, this operator L, this linearized collision operator, only acts in P, so you will never get any sort of dissipation for the gradient with respect to x out of it. But the nice thing is that you not only have the operator L, but you also have this transport part, which somehow has a sort of mixing behavior, I mean, shifts. It's mixing behavior between x and p. So this thing here, it really, really helps you to, I mean, when you compute the time derivative of this mixed part, what you find out is that this estimate holds. And here you see, here you get minus k for some addition, some other constant, minus gradient with respect to x of g squared. So this is really the thing you want to get out. Whereas these things here, they basically come from this second lemma I showed you before, this quadratic property of the operator L. And so as I said, this thing here really, the origin of this here is really the transport part, so the x dot gradient with respect to the p dot gradient with respect to x part. And of course, for this other model I've showed you before, where there is even a nonlinearity in the transport part. So for the second model I showed you, in order to get out the same to get out qualitatively the same thing here, you have to. This is basically you find out by estimating in the course of your estimates, you get this strange kind of function here, which really has to be positive. And this is really the origin of this rather strange additional restriction on the theta, because you have to guarantee that this thing is positive, and what you check, I mean, you see here's the F infinity. I mean, this is only a problem for the bosons. For the fermions, you convince yourself easily that this is always true. For the bosons, this is not so easily seen, and indeed it will be false in general, except if the theta is big enough, or alternatively if the mass is small enough. So, unfortunately, I mean, yeah, you see here is this F infinity involved, and this mu infinity also involves F infinity square, so you cannot really compute this theta star here, but you can compute it numerically. This is what we found out. Okay. So, summing up all of this together, what you find is these, I mean, you collect these three or four estimates I showed you before, so this is what you find out in the very end, with all these strange kinds of constants in front. And what you now do is you check that by choosing this initial constant, which you gave yourself to be, I mean, tunable in the functional f. So this alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, you can check that you can choose them in such a way that all of these things here are positive, and this is basically this gives the decay of this function, and this is what you want to prove. So this is sort of the first step, and which gives the decay of the H1 norm, and having done this for the this step, the other, the higher order Sobolev norms basically follow analogously, or by induction, basically. Of course, it takes a while to write it down, everything, but you can check that, I mean, everything is really in this first step. The rest is then only proceeding analogously. Okay. So now we know that the solution of the linearized equation decays exponentially fast, and all is left now is to translate this property onto the nonlinear part. And this you can do. I mean, I will not show it to you, but it is basically now a perturbation argument, right? But if this norm here of the which you have to assume to be small enough, I mean, by you conclude basically by maximum principle. And this is what I mean. You have to use certain Sobolev embeddings, which is the origin why you have this k to be, where you need this k to be big enough. Okay, so, but this you can do, and so you translate this exponential decay property from the linearized model onto the non-linearized model. Basically, I mean, if you start with a g0, which is small enough, right, that the quadratic remainder of will be even smaller. So this is the basic idea behind all of this. Okay. So this is what we were able to prove, and indeed, it was not what we have hoped for originally. And this is the last part of my talk. I want to discuss some open problems, which we faced during our studies. So I mean, as I said, we consider here this x to be on the torus in order to replace a confining potential. Of course, you might want to ask, but what if I don't want to do this? So what if I want to really work in full phase space, to take the x in Rd? And then, of course, in order to have a non-trivial steady state, what you have to do is you take into account this part here, this gradient, this forcing term here, where u has to be some confining potential in order to keep the thing together, in order to prevent the solution from decaying to zero. So typically, u would be x squared half for, say, Bose-Einstein modeling or so. And what you check then is that in this case here, the steady state is given in this form. So instead of having here only the exponential of p squared half, you have the exponential of the full energy. And of course, this theta could be absorbed into the u. And so a steady state here is basically a function of the total energy. And so you might want to ask, okay, can we prove the same thing here for this kind of model? And the answer is no. We were not able to prove it, even though we hoped to be able to do it originally. And there are basically three problems. There are two mathematical problems which appear here. And So the first thing is that this term here, this new forcing term here, which comes with a minus sign, this basically countervails this nice mixing property I've shown you before, this mixing property of this operator p dot gradient x, which we really need in the time derivative of this mixed derivative part in order to get this decay for the gradient with respect to x. So this thing here sort of works against this decay because it comes up with a minus sign. And in general, I mean, I don't know actually how to do this, but we were pretty sure that we could do it at least if the u of x is a quadratic potential. For a general potential, I don't know how to do it because you will not be able to close the set of estimates. But for a quadratic potential, this is again then basically only an x dot p, so this again quadratic, and by adjusting the coefficients in our functional, we were pretty sure that we could do it. But but in principle, you face this problem here. What is, however, more severe is the fact that this steady state here has the nasty property that it is no longer a product in x and p. So in contrast to your what you would usually have in classical kinetic theory, right, where you have a usual Maxwellian, which is the product of a Maxwellian in p times a Maxwellian in x. And since this is no longer the case, everything here, in particular, I mean, the kernel of the linearized operator, and in particular the corresponding projection and so on, everything here becomes x-dependent in a quite involved and intrigued way. So that, I mean, all the nice properties you use of, I mean, that things commute and so on are no longer true. And you pick up, I mean, in your estimates, you pick up all sorts of nasty terms which you simply cannot control. And this is basically the problem. Yeah, the source of this problem is that this steady state is no longer a product. And finally, I want to mention that also from the physical point of view, I have a problem with all of these models. Because, okay, so let's assume for a second that the confining potential is indeed x squared half. Then, I mean, the steady state here basically only depends on the radial coordinate in phase space, right? So you check you compute the total mass which is into this thing here. So you define a new radial coordinate r now, which looks similar as before. However, since you work in phase space, here you have all of a sudden a 2d minus 1 factor, or appearing in the exponent. And when you compare with the computation I did in the very beginning, you know that as soon as this exponent here is bigger than or equal than 3, you get this threshold of this mass threshold, which takes into account for Bose-Einstein condensates. But since you have here 2D now, this basically means that you would get a Bose-Einstein condensate already in spatial dimensions 2, and not only 3, which is somewhat unphysical. Because the original argument by Einstein or so, I mean, from a physical point of view, it is believed that Bose-Einstein condensates can only appear in space dimensions 3 or bigger. But here it seems you're getting a, in principle, you could also get it in space dimension 2, which from the physical point of view is somewhat dubious. And so this is, I mean, all of this is somewhat a problem which I think is one will always face by doing this quantum kinetics theory, by writing down kinetic models which take into account these steady states.
Writing
classical kinetic models. And the fact is basically that you immediately somehow, the steady state will immediately be a function of the total energy. I mean, what you would really like to have is the steady state, which is a product, and where the sort of these Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac behavior only appears in P, right? Because this would then not get you into trouble. But having this steady state to be a product, I don't know how to do it, because it will not be the kernel of the transport part, so it will not be a steady state. Even if it would be in the kernel of the collision operator, which it is, it will not be in the kernel of this part, so I don't know how to do this. Okay, so I guess I close. close here, and thank you for your attention.